Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would be remiss if I did not thank that horrendous committee you had up here. I wonder if there isn't some committee person somewhere that didn't get introduced. You, there he is, see, all right. Three more committees and I'd have been out of business. But I gotta thank that committee for inviting me here. I think this is a fantastic experience for anybody. Summerfest is wonderful. I remember when I first came to AA, I would wait. We only had one function a year. It was the provincial roundup. We didn't have conferences or conventions or things. Funfest, good God, we were in AA. This is heavy business. And, you know, I couldn't wait from year to year to have this experience. It was incredible. And now look what we have. It's great. All you diners at the round tables just look fantastic. And I'm sure those people back there in the half measures room do, too. But I think some of you at the back are damn near in Washington or Idaho or somewhere. I've been in this part of the country before. That is Seattle and Tacoma and Portland. And, you know, Idaho and California and have I missed anything? And like that. But see, AA is one thing. And it's the same all over the world, and I'm just so grateful for the opportunity to be with you here today. I've been in every one of your 50 states but two. Used to say four, but I went down to Maryland a couple of years ago, and somebody asked me that, and I mentioned it, and they said, we'll fix that right now. And I took two meetings in two different states that night. So we had a good time. I'm not here alone. I have two members of my group from Winnipeg, Manitoba here. Imagine that. Winnipeg, for those of you, I know you're all very familiar with the geography of Canada, and I really hesitate to mention this in the presence of such an erudite gathering. But Winnipeg is located in the very middle of Canada. We are about 450 or 60 miles north of Minnesota, of Minneapolis, Minnesota. So that places it exactly where you could recognize it immediately. It's cold there in the wintertime, colder than hell. We get 5 months of golf. I got a game of golf in yesterday. I thought that was utterly appropriate that you would do that, have a golf tournament at this thing. I presume that's the wave of the future. That probably will be where we will hold our spiritual meetings on Sunday morning from now on. I know that it's a very spiritual undertaking because I hear our dear Lord's name mentioned very frequently in almost every variance of it that you can think of, you know. I had the pleasure of golfing with Mike and with David, and I have to report to you that David is a better golfer than Mike. Well, the proof of that is that on the first nine, which I played with David, I had a 37. And on the back nine, which I shot with Mike, I blew to a 40, so judge for yourself. What can I say? As I was telling you, I didn't come here alone. I have a little pigeon here whose name is Nettie. She now lives in Vancouver, but got sober with us. She was a problem child. She came to me one day with a complaint that she had not yet had a spiritual experience. And I had to explain to her that Presbyterians don't have spiritual But I want you to meet her because she is going to be 10 years old tomorrow. Nettie, would you please stand up? And John is in his third year of sobriety. You can't miss him because he's 6'19" or something. And I don't know where the hell he is. He may be in bed sleeping. Are you here, John? Stand up. Let me have a look at you. There he is. Of course, John is very dear to my heart because he's a young lawyer and I'm an old lawyer and an ex-lawyer. I got rotated as a lawyer, can you imagine? And when you're rotated, that's it, I tell you. You know. I once asked my sponsor, my late sponsor, Ross McKenzie Marr, how to go about making an AA, because he knew everything, you know. And I said to him, Ross, how do you go about making a good AA talk? He said, that's simple. He said, you get a real good beginning. You get a snazzy finishing, and you keep them as close together as possible. So I've heeded that advice, and I promise you that I will not keep you here after 2 o'clock this afternoon. We'll finish it up real fast. They tell a story that kind of sets the tone for this highly spiritual address, which I am about to deliver to you all. About a little drunk that died and went to heaven, and when he got up there, he got a heavenly guide, and the heavenly guide decided to show him around and took him down a beautiful, picturesque garden path around a corner, and there were a group of people all dressed in black and looking very sad and white-faced and sort of bemoaning and beating their breasts and expressing their fear and their guilt and things like that. And little drunk looked at them and said, oh, my God, who are these people? Heavenly guide said, well, they're the Baptists. Don't make any noise or disturb them because they think they're the only ones here. They proceeded along the path and went around another turn in the path where there were beautiful flowers and shrubs. And there were a bunch of people, and they also were dressed in somber colors, and they were counting beads, and they were making strange configurations in the air, and they were kneeling and standing up, and every once in a while someone would holler bingo. And the little drunk said, oh my God, who are those people? And the heavenly guide said, well, those are the Catholics, but don't make any noise or disturb them because they think they're the only ones here. And they continued on the path around another curve where gorgeous flowers and beautiful shrubs, and there were a group of people, and oh my God, they were drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and telling dirty stories and hugging and kissing and rubbing up against, and the little drunk said to the heavenly guide, good Lord, who are those people? The heavenly guide said, well, I really don't know, but it doesn't matter a hell of a lot, they're only here for a day at a time. I want you to know this is a very serious meeting, and I'd appreciate it if you didn't laugh at all the highly spiritual points we're making here. There's a line in our book that says, in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And when I first got here, I thought that fundamental was one word. It took me some time to realize that it's three words. Fun-dam-mental. And if you don't have fun in this program, you're going to wind up damn mental. Okay, that's enough fooling around. Honor, about the middle of January 1960, things were getting kind of rough. People were beginning to complain bitterly. and things were getting to the place where even I, an erudite intellectual giant of a lawyer, began to realize that something had to be done or would be done very shortly. And being a man of great determination and decision, I decided that I would amend my life totally and completely. And being a Catholic, we're very adept at that. We have special prayers and special ways of doing that. And I was an expert in a prayer that we have, which takes 9 days. And I would start the thing, you know, and I would get 1 day, 2 days, 3 days. I don't ever remember getting 4 days, but I think I held the record in the church for starting novenas. I don't think I ever did finish one, but, you know, that was my life. So I made this decision this day that I was going to stop everything. I was going to stop smoking. I was going to stop swearing. I was going to stop drinking. I was going to stop having evil thoughts. I'll explain that a little later to you, Protestants. We're Catholics are very big on evil thoughts. And we become experts on that from the sisters. They know. I don't know how those holy women know so much about absolute filth and smut, but they're goddamn experts at it, let me tell you. They can spot it a mile away, see? So, having made that decision and having made and prayed about it and made an absolute firm resolution to never, never, never under any circumstances ever do any of those things again, and I promised God I would not, and I meant it from the roots of my toenails, I meant it. Well, I stopped smoking. I've started again, incidentally, 23 times since then. But I did. I stopped smoking. And I stopped swearing. I cleaned up my language. I did a very, very good job at that. And I worked really hard on the evil thoughts and almost succeeded. But this drinking thing threw me totally and completely. I don't know when I started drinking. But I do know that I was drunk on the third day. So the finest and firmest and most adamant resolution that I could make was of no avail, and I found myself totally and utterly defeated and lost at that point all hope, so that from that moment on I became hopeless. I was a hopeless person. There was no hope in me anywhere. It was gone. The entire world was gray, and it continued like that day by day. So from that point on, I just drank. I drank. I had not been a daily drinker up to that point, although, you know, the little sprees and whatnot had been getting closer and closer together, so it was really difficult to tell that I was really a spree drinker, because if the spree finished on Thursday, the next one had started already on Wednesday, so, you know, but I'm a periodic. I was not a low-bottom drunk, anything like that, you know. Being highly intellectual, I wouldn't stoop to anything so low as to be a daily drinking alcoholic. No way, you know. But I drank every day. And I drank all day. And I was always more or less continuously drunk. There's a line in our book that describes that period of my alcoholism very well. It says that we are more or less continually insanely drunk. And that was me. I was insanely drunk. Sanity was gone from my life, so that nothing appeared, nothing was as it appeared to be. I have a friend in California who puts this very well. He says that alcohol does the same thing to the non-alcoholic that it does to the alcoholic. Alcohol doesn't do anything differently to us than it does to them. But you see, it does something different for us than it does for them. And the thing that it does for me, that it doesn't do, for instance, to my brother who is a non-alcoholic, is that it subtly changes my perception of reality so that things as I see them are not as they are. And there I'm left in an oblique world where I don't hear the things that other people hear, and I don't see the things that other people see. And I always tell the new people in our bunch that alcoholism is really not a drinking problem. It's a hearing problem. Alcoholics don't hear a goddamn thing. You can tell them the truth right to their face, and they smile at you charmingly and say, well, but I'm not an alcoholic, you know. And that was me, see. Well, you know, I'd been drinking continuously and assiduously for about 6 days. Depends who you're talking to. Really, I feel it was only 5 days, but if you were talking to my wife when she was alive, she would have told you 6 days. But you know what those Al-Anonis are like. They tend to exaggerate things, don't they? So, whatever, whether it was 5 days or 6 days, it finally got down to the last day. I hadn't been home for that period of time, which was not unusual for me in those days. It wasn't that I didn't have a home. I did have a home, but I couldn't go home, because for me to go home was a total and constant reproach. I felt guilty. I felt horrible. I would look at those children and say, what in hell is the matter with me? What's the matter with you, Tom? Look at your children. And we had 7 children at that point. And they were beautiful children and gifted children and forgiving and loving children. And I got to the point where I couldn't stand seeing those brown eyes disappearing around the hallway door. It would tear me up and I'd have to leave. I'd find any excuse. I'd come for breakfast. My wife would be bustling around and I would be sitting there cringing, the inside of me just crumpled all to hell. And she would say something to me like, good morning, honey. And I would stamp up in the air in high dudgeon and say, if you're going to talk to me like that, I'm getting the hell out of here. And I would leave because I couldn't stand it. You were talking about dichotomy last night. Jesus, Murphy, do I know about dichotomy? You bet. Just torn by two total polar opposites and powerless over either one of them. Wanting so desperately to be the father, the husband, the lover, the mate, the helpmate, the breadwinner, and totally unable to be any of those things. And out there drinking and living in a way that had no approval from me and powerless over changing any of it, you see. I'd been drinking all day in this horrendous pub. I like to tell people it's called the Royal Albert Arms. It sounds just great, doesn't it? Can you sort of picture an old English pub with a stately fellow standing behind the bar pulling beer with one of those big long taps that they pull up here and the beer pours down here? You know, it wasn't like that. It was a dive. It's on Albert Street. That's why it's called Royal Albert Arms. And Albert Street is the street where the little gals with the short dresses and high heels walk up and down, waving at their friends who drive by in automobiles. It's amazing how many people they know, you know. And my office was right on the corner of Notre Dame, Avenue Notre Dame, and Albert Street. So for years I've been able to look out my office window and I can't see the whole Royal Albert Arms. I just see Royal Alb is all I can see from my office. But it's enough. And I look out and I say, hey, God love you. Isn't that great? Jeez, that's neat, you know. Because I associated with the very best people. I had old Tom, who was the defrocked alderman of the city, councilman, and Dick, the used car salesman, who lived on Dream Street, and Brad, the discharged beer waiter, people like that. They were, you know, intellectual people and capable of great thoughts and cogitating great ideas. Very interesting people, just horrendously so. And I had sat there all day drinking that lousy beer. Jeez, I hate beer. I only drink that because it's wet, and I only drank it when there was nothing else to drink. So I drank beer quite a bit, you know. But nothing was happening. I kept drinking it, and there's no buzz. I'm not getting up in the air, and nothing's happening. So I left there and went down Main Street 3 or 4 blocks to a sort of a private club for old retired Air Force officers, of which I happened to be one, called the United Services Institute, with some vague idea that a doctor friend of mine might stop by there to offer me some guidance and help and advice, though why I thought that particular doctor might be of assistance to me, I'm not sure. He's a vet. The bar that evening was presided over by a sometimes member of Alcoholics Anonymous, gimpy little bartender, Lori from Brandon, from the city of Brandon, Manitoba. And Lori was serving me doubles. I was drinking double scotches in those days. My credit was still good at that club, so I was practically in heaven. And I was sitting there with absolutely nothing on my mind, in a total condition of hopelessness. As I said, everything was gray, and I was just sitting there, sort of sagging, as though I would sag through the crust of the earth and perhaps wind up at the core, you know. I've heard it's molten, and it's like hell. And hell would have been a relief to me. So without hope, I was without fear. People who have no hope have no fear. I had no fear at all. Neither did I have any faith, nor did I have any love, nor did I have any understanding nor communication ability with anything or anybody. Hopelessness takes over. There's nothing else. It's at that point that you get to know what it is like not just to feel nothing. I had felt nothing for a long time. I was incapable of emotion. I was frozen inside. I stood at the grave of one of my dearest friends in the Air Force, a guy that I'd flown mission after mission with and shared everything in life with. And I stood at the foot of that grave and looked down at his casket, and nothing was there. Nothing, nothing, nothing. So it's not just to feel nothing, it's to be nothing. No being, nothing. And I reached out and picked up one of those drinks. And I got it up to about here. I don't know if the second or the third or the fourth or what it was. When I got it to here, everything changed. It was physical. Something turned over inside of me just like that. I could feel it. I could feel it then. I can feel it now. As I stand here, there hasn't been a moment since that happened that I haven't been able to feel it just by thinking about it. Something went out through the top of my head. I have no idea what that was. It was a release of some pressure. And I stood up because I was filled with absolute certainty from the skin on the bottom of my feet to the top of my longest hair that I didn't have to drink anymore. I was all through, and I knew it. And it wasn't surprising to me. It didn't raise any doubts of any kind in my mind. It wasn't a question of, I wonder if this is true. None of those things came to me. It was total, absolute certainty. It was total, absolute knowledge that permeated every fiber of my being, every cell of my body. And I got a question, nothing. I got up. I didn't say a word to my friend Lori, the bartender. I walked down the stairs to Main Street, went across Main Street to the parking lot, got in my car, found it, got lost three or four times a week, got in my car and drove home. It was about 9:15 or 9:30 on Friday evening, the 27th day of May, 1960. And when I walked in the door, my wife looked at me, and she said, would you care for some dinner? Now, let me tell you something. That ain't bad after being gone for 6 days, is it? But, you see, my wife was also a Catholic, but she had a faith. She had a program of her own. I didn't understand that for a long time after I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. And her program, which she found in the church, was identical with what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, her way of life that she was I always thought born into in her church was what I have found with you, living with the likes of you for this period of 30 some odd years, you know. An amazing thing to me, but you see, truth is truth. So why wouldn't it be the same? Of course it's the same. It's always the same, wherever you find it, in whatever corner of the world. It's an amazing thing. How simple it gets to be. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing to me that truth is truth. Does that throw you? It threw the hell out of me for a long time, I'll tell you. I thought there was one kind of truth here and a kind of truth there, and, you know, maybe my truth is better than your truth, and... not like that. Truth is truth. Humility is humility. Program is program. We don't own the program. The program is not Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a way to get to the program. What Peggy called last night, the deal. The deal. That's the deal, see? And AA is a way to get to the deal. And you find that out after a while, after you work at it and live in it and suffer it and taste it and smell it, and it permeates your entire being, but it takes time, see? So those new people who are here, that little gal with one day, God love her, I'm just so jealous and envious of her, because I know what's going to happen to her if she stays here, if she stays with you guys. I know what will happen to her. All the wonderful discoveries that she's going to make, and the suns that she will see come over the horizon, and the days that will fill her life with magic. See? Just incredible. Just incredible. Well, you know, the next morning I got up and I went to the office, and it was... I don't know how this all came about. I had no planning. I had no thought in this. I found myself dialing a telephone number of a guy that I knew, whom I had known when he was drinking, seen him walking down the street with his beard and his nose all over his face, you know. We used to say to him, "Ross, for Christ's sake, why don't you get your nose fixed?" And he'd say, "I did. It used to be over here, you know." And shuffling along with his big, long, blue overcoat on, five-button job, didn't have five buttons, only had three, big safety pin up here, torn sleeve, torn pocket, you know. And then I'd seen him change. I'd seen him in a three-piece suit, and he had a job with an insurance company, and he looked clean, and that's how I got to meet him. Personally, I'd just seen him drunk. I hadn't met him personally at that point, but he was working for an insurance company, and that happened to be a client of mine, and so I got, you know, I was introduced to him, and people treated him respectfully, and he was making a living, and he was doing pretty well. Obviously, someone they thought well of. So when I was in all of this trouble, I had asked somebody, "What happened to that guy?" And they said something to me about AA, and that was all I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew nothing about it. I just knew that there was this thing called AA. Not even knowing what it meant. I phoned that guy, this Ross. And I said, "Ross, I want to talk to you." And he came right to my office. And, you know, he was a big book guy. He had read the big book. And that part in the big book that tells you how you go about making the first 12-step entry call, it says don't overstay your welcome. It gives you the idea, maybe 30 minutes or something like that, and just lay the heavy facts on the guy, the stark and ugly facts, and let him think about it a little bit, and then maybe go back the next day and sort of mop up a little bit. Well, you know, Ross, he didn't read that. He didn't pay any attention to that. He stayed with me for 9 hours. I finally caved in and said, "Okay, for Christ's sake, I'll do whatever you say." I didn't know what else to do. He wore me out, you know. And so I met him on a Monday evening. That was on Saturday. And we didn't have that many groups in Winnipeg in those days. I think we had 5 or 6 groups. And I met him at his group, 167 Lilac Street, the old Winnipeg group. It's in an old abandoned grocery store. And He wouldn't take me to a meeting. He said, meet me there. He wanted to know if I meant it or didn't mean it. And, of course, in those days, I had to ride the bus because I couldn't drive my car. Not that there was anything wrong with the car. But, you know, in Canada, we in those days had a queen, and God, she's a narrow-minded broad. She had removed my driving privileges, and I was not able to drive my vehicle. So I showed up at the Winnipeg group at 8:30 on Monday night. It's their meeting, and nervous as all get out. You know, you remember what it's like going to that first meeting? I walked up and down that block, I'm sure, for 20 minutes before the meeting. The sweat pouring down my sides, wondering how the hell am I ever, I wonder who's looking at me, you know, who's watching me going in that door. If I go in that door, everybody's going to know what I'm going in there for. And it was a scary deal. But I went in the door, and I hadn't been inside more than 10 feet when some guy yelled, hey, there's Grafton. Jeez, we've been waiting for you for 5 years. So they took me in and gave me a cup of coffee, which was an experience for me because I had a little trouble holding a cup of coffee. It tended to float a little, and I'd get both hands on it, and they didn't work together. Ever had that experience? One hand works against the other. And God, it's worse than ever when you're like that. And, you know. And then if somebody else comes along and offers you a cookie, boy, you are in big trouble, let me tell you. So I had to rush over and set the coffee down somewhere and then lean over and sip it, you know, like that. A friend of mine said when he got in, it was so bad, what he would do, he would hang out of the cup and he'd take his tie off, put his tie over, and he'd hang out of the tie and he'd pull the tie and it was coffee. Okay. He got to do that, see? Alcoholics are very ingenious people, we find a way to drink coffee, you know. I would approach my sponsor because I wanted to tell him my troubles. I was full of troubles. And I wanted to share those things with him and tell him just how bad I felt. God, I felt bad. And I had so many problems and so many troubles. And I would start to tell him my troubles. I would say, Ross, listen, what in the hell am I going to do? I got a letter here from the Law Society, and they're threatening to pull my ticket, and I don't know what on earth. And he'd say, just a minute. And I'd say, what? He'd say, I want to tell you about the time that I got drunk and in the Fort Garry Hotel, and they took me up to the nut factory on Emily Street. And I had to spend a week up there. And I'd say, Ross, I don't want to know about that goddamn place. I want you to tell me what to do. He'd say, just wait till I tell you this story. You know, it got to the place where I all but despaired of ever telling him any of my problems. But one night, oh, man, I had a problem. I had a doozy. I don't remember now what it was, but it was fantastic. So I grabbed old Ross. And I took him by the elbow and I said, Ross, come on over here in the corner. I gotta talk to you. You gotta talk to me tonight. I got a problem that is so serious that you have to listen to it and you gotta tell me. And a gleam came in his eye, which I took to be a gleam of human kindness. And loving hopes sprung in my breast. And he took me then by the elbow and guided me to that corner. And as I got there, I expected him to perhaps put a fatherly arm around my shoulder and say, Tom, I realize I've been kind of hard on you. And I really do want to know all about your problems. And I will give you the best advice of which I'm capable. Please come and tell me all about it. Well, that is not what happened. He wheeled me around and he gave me a forefinger push in the wishbone, which some sponsors reserve for recalcitrant recruits. And he looked me in the eye with that steely glaze of his, and he said to me these highly spiritual words, "Grafton, you ain't got a problem. You are the goddamn problem." Well, being a highly intelligent lawyer and very quick on the uptake, it only took me about 4.5 years to hear that. That's why I say alcoholism is a hearing problem. I didn't hear that. But I did hear some things, and it was wonderful how this, you see, our book tells us that experience is the thing of value in life, the great thing, and that's true. Henry Ford apparently said that, and he, I don't know. It's true only if you use the experience. But experience after experience after experience is of no value whatsoever if you don't use it. So I'm in this group, brand new there, and there was a guy there who was a car man for the railroad company. He cleaned railroad cars, passenger cars and baggage cars and stuff like that. His name was Gilbert Bleh. He was a little French-Canadian guy. And I didn't know you spoke French before. You didn't tell me that, for God's sake. How come? I had never even heard you swear in French. Anybody who speaks French swears beautifully. French is a language with wonderful swear words. And Gilbert came up to me, and he said to me, "Grafton, they tell me you're a lawyer. Is that true?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a lawyer. Why?" He said, "Oh, I don't know. Ha, 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 ha." I said, "What in the hell's that about? What does that mean?" He said, "Well, Tom, we've had lots of lawyers in this group. Lawyers don't stay sober." And somewhere deep down inside of me, there was a little voice. I didn't say anything to him. But inside of me, this little voice said, "Oh, yeah, you some bitch. This is one lawyer that's going to stay sober." He did me a favor. What a wonderful thing to happen. See, experience I was able to use immediately. Of course, I didn't understand in those days what I've since come to see and understand and witness many, many, many times. Why would not the power use a car cleaner with tobacco-stained teeth and bad breath to tell me something that I had to hear? Why not? Of course that's how it is. That's why it's so necessary for us to be together all the time and to share things. Because you may think you're sharing with this individual, this person, this somebody whom you know as whatever, but it may be the power that is speaking, using the voice of that person and saying something that you absolutely need to hear, you see. I spoke to Gilbert Bleh. I hadn't seen him for years, and I saw him, well, just a while ago. Now, Gilbert's 30-some years sober, and he's no longer a car cleaner, and he's got a family and a business of his own, and he's doing very, very well. Thank you very much. God looked after Gilbert real good. And I put it to him. I said, "Gilbert, do you remember this? Do you remember that I described it to him?" He said, "Oh, God, Tom, no. I never would have had the nerve to tell you that." I said, "Well, is it true? Was it true?" He said, "Oh, hell yes, it was true." Oh, brother. See, experience you can use, experience you can't use. So I was one of those happy people who fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I just thought it was great. I didn't understand, you see, that there are two sides to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really think that if there's a weakness, and I've heard this argued at general service level and intergroup level and the level of the general service board and everywhere you can imagine, the weak spots in AA, you know, somebody says, "Oh, well, it's sponsorship, our sponsorship's going all to hell," and, you know, but they don't come and sit in rooms like this. If they did, they would know that that's not true. Your sponsorship is good here. I know that. Your AA is good here. I know that. I've heard nothing but good A's since I came here. So I might not talk much about it this morning, because maybe that ain't why you brought me here. You don't need that stuff, see? Maybe you do. anyway. I kind of lost my train. Don't get worried about that. If I, you know, I'm going along somewhere and I lose a train of thought, don't get excited about it. When I first got sober, I was sober maybe, I don't know what, 6 months or something like that. I got hauled out to a little roundup at a town called Pine Falls, Manitoba, and they asked me to talk, and being, as I was, brand new, I didn't know any better, so I said, okay. And I stood up, and I'm starting to talk, and I got one of these blackouts, but I wasn't worried at all because my sponsor's sitting right in the front row, looking right at me. And I had to discuss this with him, and I said, Ross, help me out, will you? I got one of those blank spots. What was I talking about? He said, hell, I don't know. I wasn't listening. It seems to me that if there is a weakness anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's because our fellowship is too good. It's too great. It's too exciting. It's too alluring. It's too attractive. We talk about a program of attraction rather than promotion. Yeah. But God, the fellowship is so attractive. I fell in love with it totally. And I got into every kind of activity you could think of. My old sponsor got me into jail groups, into AA, took me out to a jail group, said, you're the sponsor. I'm a sponsor of a jail group. I'm 2 weeks sober. I didn't know what the hell was going on, you know. But those cons took me in, and sure, they were great. They were great to me. I learned a lot about jail AA. And I've had a weak spot in my heart ever since for institutional AA. If there's anybody here that has an institutional background, believe me, you're welcome. We don't have no second-class citizens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We just have alcoholics, that's all. And that little gal that came in today is her first day. She's got just as much to say about what is going to happen and take place in Alcoholics Anonymous as I have with the more than 33 years sobriety. We're equal here. We're all equal. And of course, there's a very, very good reason for that. The reason is that we all have the same Father, and we're all God's kids. And God don't pick and choose between his kids. He don't have no chosen people. He just has kids. And if you get here and you can get into this program and make the surrender and accept this way of life as your way of life, the moment you're able to be here and be with us, you have every benefit that can flow to you if you can accept it. It's not a question of God not having something to give you. He's got everything to give you. The only question is, you got the ability to accept it. And of course, most of us don't, because we like to hang on to stuff, you know. Geez, we do like to hang on to those problems, don't we? I mean, they're my problems, you know, and they're, God, they're important. And hell, they're mine. And I'm not about to let them go. So I'm standing there in front of my Father, and he's very patiently smiling at me and saying, Tom, I got some real good stuff for you here. It's kind of neat. I know that it would fit right into your life. And I do love you. And I'd sure enough like you to have this if you'd take it. Would you accept it from me? And I'm standing there with both hands full, and I'm saying, well, okay, but what am I going to do about my problems?
Let go? What's that? Like I never heard the words before. So I hang on to that lousy marriage or that lousy job or that trouble spot or that health problem or that lawsuit or whatever the hell it is for dear life, because it's mine and I don't want to let it go. And there's my dear father just standing there shaking his head kind of sadly and saying, well, kid, when you get ready, you let her go, and then look what I got for you. I got a friend of mine who's a psychologist named Duffy. Great fellow, you can tell right away, can't you? Irish, obviously. Alcoholic, obviously. Well, they go together, did you know that? Huh? Somebody said, I belong to the CIA, Catholic Irish Alcoholic. That's... So Duffy must. I never met the guy, but I've read a lot of his stuff. And he says that the two greatest blunders in life are the refusal to make a commitment, and secondly, the refusal to let go. And I've found that to be the case in my life. I've proven that. Until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous and made a commitment, I didn't do that when I came here. I came here and fell in love with the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I hear people say, when I came to the program, and then they give their dry date, well, I can't do that, because I didn't come to the program when I got sober. I came to the fellowship and fell in love with the fellowship and stayed with the fellowship for 7.5 years. Oh, if you'd asked me what, have you done, my sponsor was always snapping at my tail about doing the steps, crabby old goat. You know, says he wouldn't leave me alone on that stuff. Every time I talked to him, it was the same thing. He had 5 things he would tell me. Don't drink. God, I heard that till I was sick of it. I don't know why he would think it necessary to tell me that after a month or 2 months. I'd heard it 100 times. Just 2 words. I know what it means. You know, he wouldn't let up on me. Boy, he drilled that into the back of my head. It got to be like an auger, like a, you know, an oar. It would go brrrr, down, brrrr. Oh, my God. And I had to listen to it. You know, he was my sponsor. And I knew what that meant. No one ever explained it to me. I just knew what it meant. I knew a lot of things about AA that nobody explained to me. I knew that if you ever went out and drank again, they would never let you back. That was a rule. I knew that. And I knew that if I ever took a drink, he would never even speak to me again. He'd probably go get a hitman to finish me off, you know. Oh, I tell you, you guys don't realize what a tough outfit you were when I came. And I was starting to develop fear. I was starting to recognize fear. I didn't have any fear when I was drinking because I was totally numb. I was totally frozen, you know. I'd been flying airplanes and stuff like that, and you can't have fear when you're doing things like that. People shooting at you and all that crap, see? So, little by little, the humanizing process began in simple things like that. And he would tell me, don't drink. Meetings, 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 meetings. Be at the meetings. Pick a meeting. This is your meeting. And you be at that meeting, and you be there every week at that meeting. If you have to miss another meeting, okay. But at your meeting, you are there. That's your meeting. You be there. Consequently, I was at a meeting every night for a couple of years. For way more than 1.5 years. Because I wasn't quite sure which meeting he was going to designate as my meeting. And he was such a scabby old rat that I knew if I picked a Thursday to miss, he'd say, where the hell were you when your meet night was on? Whichever one I missed would be my meeting. I knew that, you know. So I hit every damn one for a couple of years because I wouldn't trust him, you know. I didn't trust nobody. Don't drink. Meetings, meetings, meetings. Read the book. Of course I read the book. I got a book the first night, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he also gave me a book that had just come out. It was called AA Comes of Age. It was the first history of AA that was ever written. It's the story of our international conference in Cleveland in 1950 that we put on for Dr. Bob, who was at death's door, and we wanted him to see what he had accomplished in his lifetime. And we let him see several thousand sober people in Kiel Auditorium in Cleveland, and Bill was standing up on the stage, and they brought Bobby in to speak, and of course Bob was, God, he was deathly ill. They didn't, the guy that drove the car that brought him was a friend of mine, he's now gone, Steckman, Al Steckman, you knew Al Peggy, and a beautiful human being in his own right. And he told me, he said, God, we didn't think we were going to get... He's up there on the platform for about a minute and a half or something. He did that last message of his. I don't know if you've ever heard the tape of it, but if you haven't, please get it, and please listen to it, and think about it. This is Bob talking to us. And he says that there are two vital things in Alcoholics Anonymous. Firstly, love, and secondly, service. And then he says, astoundingly to me, he says, everybody knows what love is. Oh, God, who is he talking to? I was here for a hell of a long time before I knew what love was. I didn't know what love was. I thought love was something physical, something that created horrendous emotion in me. I didn't realize that love is work. And he said, everybody knows what service is. So love and service, it's like they're synonymous things that carry us into life and through life to whatever lies beyond for all of us, you see. And I certainly didn't know what service was, so I didn't know what the hell Bob was talking about. I didn't know how he could connect those two things and say love and service, that's... Of course, now I see it because I, thank God, had that experience of going through the service structure. I put in, I guess, 20 years in service, firstly with that institutional thing and then intergroup and then the birth of general service in our province. We started with nothing, with nothing. Nobody had ever heard of a GSR. Nobody knew what a DCM was. In fact, we didn't have DCMs in those days. They called them area committee members, area committee men. But I found out something. It didn't really matter whether you were AC or DC, the work was the same. The work was the same, you know. And I went all through that and, you know, then eventually got to be delegate when I was 7.5 years sober. They elected me delegate. Now, wouldn't you think that that would be a triumphal moment in your AA life? But, you know, that isn't how God works. God has one idea in mind. He wants to shave off self. He wants to scale it off and flake it off and get rid of it because of that ego thing that Peggy was talking to us about last night. That self-centeredness that Bill warned us about right in the beginning of the book is our death knell. He says selfishness kills. Doesn't say anywhere in the book that booze is going to kill you, but by God, Bill says we must get rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. How does he do that? He does it because selfishness is the absence of, and we come to learn and see that the only thing that can separate me from the power, the only thing that can separate me from God, the only thing that can separate me from my Father is that human ego, and it has to go. And that's why I don't believe in the word choice. I sit in meetings and I hear people say things like, my, it's so nice to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that I have the power of choice restored to me, and I say to myself, what are they talking about? What choice is that? Like I missed something somewhere along the way, see? To me, choice is an ego word. What does it mean? It means I choose. And let me tell you something, kids. When I start choosing, old Tom is in trouble. Right now. Right now. If there are two options and I choose, guess which one I'm going to choose? Huh? The wrong one, for damn sure. That's what's going to happen. Okay? So we don't use that word much where I go to AA, because I jump on people. And I didn't make that up. I have some pretty strong precedent for that. If you recall that part of chapter 4 in our book where Bill says, we had to face the fact. He doesn't say right away, he says after a while. Now, after a while, what does that mean? 2 days? 3 weeks? 6 months? 6 years? In my case, it was 7 years. Almost 7.5. After a while, we had to face the fact that we must, not a suggestion, this is not a suggestion, we must adopt a spiritual way of life, long dash, or else. Now, you can ask any lawyer in this room what or else means, and he'll tell you quickly, it has nothing to do with choice. It does not signify a choice. And that is not what Bill was telling us. Bill was telling us, kids, this is a way of life that you better get into as quickly as you can. And that's what my old sponsor was telling me. That's why he said don't drink. That's why he said meetings, meetings, meetings. That's why he said read the book. Do the steps. He didn't tell me read the steps. Understand the steps. I sometimes talk to people who say, I can't do that step. And I say, why? And they say, I don't understand it. And they say, I don't believe it. And they say, I don't like it. And I say to them, you are among the luckiest people in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is not a requirement that you understand it. It is not a requirement that you believe it. And it sure as hell is not a requirement that you like it. It's just a requirement that you do it. You got that? Sometimes I make people sick. I like music. I got a quadraphonic sound system in my car and speakers in front and back, and I love jazz. I'm a jazz aficionado. Is that right? No, that's not the right word. Fan, anyway, whatever the hell. And I like Duke Ellington and stuff like that. And I'm driving down the street one day and I hear this little band. I know it's a little black band. This little gal is singing, and oh man, she's singing her heart out. It's got a jazzy beat, and it's the perfect AA song. Oh God, I couldn't wait to get back to my group to share this song with them. I'm no longer a musician, and I never did sing, but I caught the lyrics right away, and they're so simple, and for alcoholics, it's got to be simple, you know that. So I took the lyrics back to them and shared it with them, and I'm going to share it with you. It goes like this. Do it, 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 do it. All right. When we were having that call-up session before this meeting started and we got into that rhythmic clapping, that's what I was thinking about. Do it, 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 do it. We gotta do it. Because if you don't do it, nothing happens. It's the law. If you take the action, you get the result. If you don't take the action, no result. None. Nothing. So you can sit around and discuss the steps till hell freezes over. You can interpret them all you like. You can translate them. You can do whatever you like with them. But if you don't do them, you are not going to change. Nothing will change. It's in the doing. You see, there's a difference between activity and action. Activity, actually, in the church, is regarded as a heresy. It's just doing something for the sake of doing something, like putting on a show, you know. They're impatient with me sometimes because I don't like people to stand up and tell me how grateful they are. You stand up and tell me how grateful you are, I'm liable to say bullshit. I want you to show me that. You show me that. That's an example. And you show me that, and hey, I'm with you all the way. If you show me, you don't have to tell anybody. It's going to glow right out of your skin. It will show in your life and in your action. It's not something you have to explain to anybody. To anybody. It's what you do, you see. So the difference between activity and action is activity, just doing something for doing something. But action, that's activity with a plan. With a plan. And that changes everything. And here's the plan. God, are we lucky. This is the only place in the entire world that the plan for recovery is written down. And we're so damn lucky because it sucks us in to get recovered so we can start to get healthy in body first and then in mind and then emotionally and then spiritually. Somewhere along the line, somebody says something to us about being spiritual. And we've been here long enough and we're sober enough that our toes don't cringe anymore. And we can listen, at least listen. Because we think it's something different. We think it's something horrendous. We think it's something awful that's probably going to require something, you know, maybe our chin on our navel or something like that. You know, sad. Be sad. Be sad. Yeah. God loves you. God loves you. No shit. Hey, it's a good deal, kids, you see. So we take the action and we get the result. And we find ourselves liking it because we share it and we get to do it together. It's totally a reprogram. And that's how we do it and live it where I live, in my bunch, in my group. We do all the steps together. When I'm working on step one, everybody's on step one. Or whoever's leading the series. Seldom me now because I'm too damn old. And, you know, well, I'm at the age where I don't buy green bananas. And when the group's doing step two, everybody's on step two because we share it. That's where it comes from. The we part means that we do it together, see? Because nothing in this program depends upon you. Nothing in this program depends upon me. It depends only upon the power, that's all. So the faster I can get rid of self, get that self stuff the hell out of the way, the power gets a chance to roll in. It's like a vacuum. I don't know if you remember when you were in high school, you'd get a bell jar and you'd pump the air out of it and create a vacuum. And then you let the valve go and pew, it's full immediately. Rushes, the atmosphere rushes in and fills up the bell jar. It's like that. When we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we're stuffed with self. It's crammed down in there tight. And we start letting it go little by little, a little fragment here and a little shred there and a little piece here, like that. And as the self goes out, the power comes in. It's automatic. You don't do anything about it. Nothing. Just put yourself at the disposal of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and let it happen to you. And all you have to do is show up at the meetings, get yourself a sponsor, and do what we do. So when we're working on the first step, you work on the first step. You know? And when you see that there's a price that has to be paid, like Bill says, then you get yourself ready to pay that price. Say, I'm willing. I'm willing. I don't know how to live. You guys look happy. You guys look like things are good with you. And God has given you some kind of serenity. And when I got here, I had no concept of what the word serenity meant. You know what that was? Peace of mind? What's that? I had that squirrel cage thinking where my mind is going 24 hours a day. Couldn't relax, couldn't stop. I was active, but no action. You see? Incredible. So we learn to live in step one because it's the surrender step. We say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic. Powerless over alcohol. Life unmanageable by me, you bet. Oh, yes. beyond human aid? Yes, I am. Totally beyond human aid. I know that because I make an inventory in step one of all the people who tried to help me, and hundreds of wonderful people tried to help me. They couldn't do it. Doctors couldn't help me. They didn't know what the hell alcoholism was, and there wasn't anything they could do about it anyway. See, this is a spiritual thing, totally. Our book tells us we have a spiritual disease which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Nothing else will conquer it. That's sometimes I get a little impatient with some of the other programs and some of the treatment centers, because they keep telling us things like, it's an addiction. Alcoholism is an addiction. And drugs is an addiction. And this is an addiction, and that's an addiction. And it's all one thing. And the AA program is marvelous. So everybody go, and you'll be okay, see? Well, it's not the same problem. We're alcoholics. I don't know what those other people are. It's none of my business. But we're alcoholics. And we belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we must stay with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we must work with each other. Now, I don't worry about those other people. Don't worry about them. Lots of them come to our group. We got lots of people coming to our group. They're not alcoholic. They don't bother me at all because they don't stay. I don't go to the door and take a blood test, you know. What the hell are you doing in here? You ain't even an alcoholic. Get the hell out. I did that with a little guy a couple of years ago. I didn't do it like that. He came into the group, and all he wanted to talk about was drugs, you know. He was a real hard ass. He'd come in and he'd say things like, first of all, he told us he was duly addicted, so everybody said, hi, Dooley. And then he told us, you know, that he was a drug addict. I'm an addict. And he wouldn't switch, and he wanted to talk about that all the time, so I told him, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting is for alcoholics. You're not an alcoholic. Get the hell out. And I threw him out. Sent him to Narcotics Anonymous. He didn't like it. I ran across this little guy about two or three weeks ago at another group named Sean. And he's sitting there, and I'm just waiting to see what's going to happen. And he sits up, and it comes to his turn, and he says, my name's Sean. I'm an alcoholic. And I said, thank God. Thank God. He was always an alcoholic. I knew that. But he didn't know it. He had to find it out. And he found it out. And now he's one of us. And I know what's going to happen to him as long as he keeps coming with us. What happened to me? What happened to Peggy? What happened to those people with 35 years and 34 years and 29 years and 28 and 21 and so on? That's what's going to happen to him. He's going to get to be happy, joyous, and free. See, it's no big deal, kids. We know what God's will. I hear it meetings. I wonder what God's will for me is, you know. And we almost have conventions about that. And the book is very clear. The book says we are sure that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. That's good enough for me. I'll take that. I kind of like that, you know. And it says things like, we insist upon enjoying life. Hey, I'm in favor of that. I sure enough am. See? And the things that will happen to you, oh man, how are you doing for time? We have lots of time? Have we? 2 o'clock. Oh, not 2 o'clock yet. I'm in 2 o'clock today. All right. I just wanted to share a couple of little things with you. Because, you know, things happen to you in this program that you cannot explain. You can experience them, but you can't explain them. And I've come to the conclusion that the reason we don't explain them or be able to explain them is they're none of our business. It's none of my business. See? I got called to go down to a place called Grand Rapids to do a thing, and what they wanted me to do was get there a day early and talk to a bunch of doctors and nurses and interns and care workers and stuff like nurses and stuff like that. And the weekend I was supposed to go, the weather closed in like, you know, oh God, the way it does on the prairies, it's something else. And nothing was moving. The airplanes weren't flying, the railroads weren't railroading, and I sure as hell wasn't going to drive. The visibility was down to zilch, but the buses were running. So this guy down there, his name is Vern. Vern says, well, you can get the bus, you know. It's my life, for God's sake. He says, that's all right, you get the bus, you know. So I go down, get a bus ticket, and get on the bus. And to go to Winnipeg from Grand Forks, it's 150 miles, and on a clear day, it takes us about 2.5 hours to get there, because there's not much fuzz on the highway. And that day, it took us from 6 o'clock in the morning till 12:30 noon to get that 150 miles, because you couldn't see a damn thing. And when we got there, they said, all buses are canceled. You guys have got off the bus from Winnipeg, you want to go home, you better get on that bus that's leaving right now, and we left. It's 35 miles to Grafton. It took us 4 hours to go that 35 miles. And we're down to like 5 miles an hour, 2 miles an hour. We're going around a curve, and the bus driver looks out and says, hey, we're stopped. The speedometer showed 25 miles an hour. A gasoline truck went by us, a huge thing. You could not have put a package of cigarettes between the truck and us. And imagine what would have happened if that truck had hit us. There would have been the biggest explosion you ever saw. We left Grafton. There are 11 people in the driver on this bus. That's 12, right? I'm sitting halfway back on the left-hand side. Pretty soon I notice there are 2 people in the seat with me. Now, there ain't supposed to be just one. There's 2, all right? There's 3 people in the seat in front of me. There's 3 people in the seat behind me. That's 9. And there's 2 people in the seat immediately across from me. So the whole 11 passengers are like that. And we go like that for about 10 miles. And then the bus driver stops the bus. He comes back. He said, excuse me, sir. If you don't mind, would you please come up to the front and sit beside me? I would feel better. And I said, I'd be glad to do that. So I got up, excused myself, went up to the front, sat down behind the driver, right behind him, put my hand on his shoulder. And by God, in 2 seconds, I got them other 10 people gathered all around me with a little clock right up like that at the front. And nobody said a word. The girl who was sitting beside me came from Germany the night before. She'd never been in North America before. We're in a blizzard. You know what a blizzard is? A blizzard is like snow and wind to the point where you can't see and you can't hear. People who have lived on a farm all of their lifetime will get lost between the house and the barn. They've done that 20 times a day for all their lives, and they get lost because you're totally disoriented, you see, and it's like that. We drove like that till we got to the border, and at the border, things changed. It was like the curtain went up, and all of a sudden, it's clear. And all of those passengers and the driver just filtered back to where they were sitting anyway, and I'm halfway back on the left-hand side of the bus, driving along, humming and looking out the window, and saying to myself, isn't it wonderful? Isn't it wonderful? See, there's a power. There's a communication. There's a spiritual something that we get to be part of that we do not understand and that we will never understand, but it's a part of a system of communication between God's kids. And all those people are God's kids, just like I am. No difference at all. They have their program, whatever that may be, successful or unsuccessful. That's none of my business. But I got to share with them just like I share with anybody. And I didn't even know I was sharing. What happened? I don't know what happened. I just know that that's what took place. That's what took place, you see. There's so many things that we do not understand. We think that the brain and the mind, perhaps the same thing. It's not like that. My wife went to the hospital with a stroke that removed the left side of her brain. Shortly thereafter, a week or 10 days, she had another stroke that removed the right-hand side of the brain. So she was totally and utterly unable to communicate or feel or give any sign of life other than breathing shallow breathing, interrupted by apnea, if you know what that is, and unable to feed herself or feed in any way whatsoever. We tried force feeding, it didn't work. Didn't work. She would reject that. And forcefully reject it. It was as though there was another will there. It was as though something was going on in her experience that she was sharing with something or some being that was not open to me. But I could feel it. I could sense it. I knew it was there, you see. I came out of my house one morning about 7:45 on my way to see a client. And being a lawyer, I had all kinds of things in my hand, briefcase, keys, papers, and one thing, or envelopes, one thing or another. And when I stepped outside the kitchen door, I closed it, and it went click, and I knew it was locked. I realized, I haven't got my keys. I haven't got my car keys. And I looked in the window of the back door, and sure enough, there they are on the kitchen table. Now, what am I going to do? I can't get my car out of the garage. I can't get on with my business. I have no other set of keys on me. I don't want to smash in the door. I can't go and get my daughter who lives a block away because she's already gone to work. I didn't know what to do. And as I stood there cogitating all of this, it was as though a clear message came to me, and I walked into the garage. Immediately inside the garage, there's an automatic door opener which operates from a bar on the bottom. You just hit the bar, and the door opens. I'd done that every day for 20 years. That morning, I walked in, I put my hand on top of it. I'd never done that in my life before. And I picked up a brand new set of keys to my back door. I opened the back door, got my keys, closed the back door, put those back keys back on top of that door opener, and I've never seen them since. I don't know where they are. But they opened the door. And I went and saw my client and went and saw my wife in the hospital that day. But I know where that communication came from. I asked my kids about those keys for several months. And my daughter, Mary, who's a nurse, said to me, Dad, I seem to remember now that 3-4 years ago, Mother locked herself out of the house. And she had a bad experience. And she said to me sometime after, that'll never happen to me again. I have a set of keys that are hidden. I hid my keys, and no one will ever know where they are, but she knew where they were, and she's the only one who knew where they were. So the message that I got had to come from her, but she had no mind. Her brain was totally erased. How do these things happen? Who knows? Who knows? We experience it. We're grateful for it. We recognize it as being the hand of the Father. I look back over all of my AA life and I see the finger of God traced through the whole thing. Or I wouldn't be here, you know. I couldn't be here. Not the way my life has unfolded. But here I am. See? The fear of death is gone. It has no meaning for me whatsoever because I know that life does not end. If life were to end, then God would be less than infinite. And I know that He's the infinite Father, I'm the infinite child, as you are, and we're on an infinite journey. So it will never end. Your experience will never end. God wanted me to know that, so He brought it to my attention. We have a little roundup at the university where I belong, and it's in my group, it's the university group. And I had some of my friends come in to yak at that thing, and we met them and we had a long talk, finished, we had dinner and then finished. I went home to bed, got to bed about 11 o'clock, and I think I went to sleep. My little baby daughter was living with me then, she was studying in the kitchen, and I'm not sure, I think I went to sleep. In any event, in a moment I was no longer in that bedroom, I was transported to the house where we used to live at number 1 Iroquois Bay. And I was in the kitchen, not the way the kitchen is now, but the way it was when we first got it. And I'm sitting in the kitchen, it's all done yellow. My wife was an interior decorator. And she was sitting on the other side of the kitchen table. Her side was white and everything there was white. And it was almost like a classroom, but the desks were so comfortable and beautiful and clean. And she was just bubbling. She was about 28 years old and dark hair and gorgeous, gorgeous eyes and as beautiful as I ever saw her in her entire lifetime, and just bubbling with vitality and life, and explaining to me what she was doing and how things were. And my attention was riveted on a wristwatch she had on her arm because it had a dial that was moving. It didn't have hands and figures. It had concentric circles that were moving in one direction or the other direction. And she saw me looking at that, and she said to me, "Oh, that's wisteria." It wasn't wisteria, but that's as close as I can come to it. And I still didn't understand. And then she informed me that this is how we keep time here. I said, "Time? Time? Why would you need..." I understood she was in eternity. I understood that. Nobody explained that to me. I just knew that. I was filled with certain knowledge of that, just as I had been the night that I went to pick up that drink and suddenly was filled with super knowledge that had nothing to do with me. And there I am talking to my wife, who had at that time been dead for over a year, and I'm talking to her like I'm talking to you. This isn't something imagined or something that wasn't there immediately before me. And she told me things were fine with her. She knew what the kids were doing and she was pleased, and she knew what I was doing and she was pleased. Because she knows that I've given my entire life to AA and have for many, many, many years. That's just how it is. In our book it says, those people who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. I like to say it the other way. Those people who can and do are people who will give their lives completely. And that's what I've tried to do. Perfectly? No. Best I can do. Good enough? Apparently. Apparently. Just keep getting comfortable. Just keep getting better and better friends. Just keep getting a better life. If I told you what my life is like now, you probably wouldn't believe me. It's the best life I've ever had, the only easy life I've ever known. I've worked so hard all my life, fought everything, tried. God says to me, quit trying. Trying's dying. Just do it and enjoy it. Look for the answer where it is. We have a common solution, but you find your answer, you see. And it's not up there somewhere in the mountains, or out in the valley, or in the temple, or maybe Jerusalem. It's in your heart and your mouth that you might know it and do it. I want to close this meeting with a thing that we do at my group every meeting we have. We share that last page 164. This is so powerful. This is so wonderful. Bill says, God, he was something else, that guy. And it was my great privilege to know him and spend time with him. I'd love to be able to talk to you. I could talk to you about Bill for an hour. He was so marvelous. God, we were lucky to have him. And Carl Jung, oh, what a fascinating human being. He's the guy that put us on the track. He's the guy that explained the hazard. No. I made a mistake with you. You're not a neurotic idiot. You're what is known as an alcoholic, and that's totally a spiritual disease. You told him that. Did I make a mistake in your case? I misdiagnosed you. I didn't understand you were an alcoholic. Now I see that you are. And that's totally spiritual. And gave him a verse of my favorite psalm, the 42nd psalm. He said to him, as the heart, H-A-R-T, panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul for thee, O God. Yeah, that's the alcoholic. Looking for the great reality. Oh, yes. I want life to be real. I want it to have a meaning. I want it to have a purpose. And I got all those things by coming with you and living like you and the way you showed me to live. And our book tells us, Bill tells us, patiently, he says, still you may say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who wrote this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So you must remember your real reliance is always upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Has he done that? I guess. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. Boy, what a humble guy, huh? You wrote this thing. You realize we know only a little. I'd like to know a little like that. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. And that's what I've been trying to tell you. My life has been one disclosure followed by another disclosure. And I know where it all goes. If you could see my family, if you could see my kids. I got 9 kids. They're all married, well married. My sons are the kind of husbands I wanted to be. My daughters are the kind of family members I wanted to be. I have 17 grandchildren, all healthy, all wonderful. We got together on Father's Day. We used to do it Mother's Day, but Mother's gone, so now it's Father's Day. 36 Graftons there. Everybody's sober. Nobody fighting. Playing in the pool. Having a hell of a time. Enjoying life. It's called enjoying life. It's called living. It's called sharing. See? Living in God. He answers, he says, ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day. Each day. This ain't a sometime thing, kids. We have to be the Good Samaritan every day. For the man who is still sick, doesn't say for the man who hasn't yet gotten to AA, for the man who's still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And just in case anybody here, anybody reading this book, wonders, what does he mean, great fact? What's the great fact? Bill never put something like that without giving us the answer. The answer's on page 25. He says, the great fact is just this, and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never accomplish for ourselves. That's our great fact. And then he finishes with pure Oxford group. We owe a debt to the OGs. We came. Part of our program came out of the OGs. And Bill finishes with that, and I think it's so appropriate. He says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Whatever you think that is. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. That's Oxford group. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of heaven.